Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, what Uyghurs eat. We find out the cuisine of this Chinese community. California's farmers are dealing with drought, pestilence, and budget cuts. How they're faring under these stresses. Delicious cold soups for summer. And even in this country, there are communities that lack running water. What one group is doing about it. But first, let's see what's in season this week in California from the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We've managed to catch up with DJ Olson, who is the chef over at Lou. It's one of our favorite restaurants, Lou, and DJ's here every week. And DJ always is walking around with a big cart loaded with goodies. And so can you share another one of your great recipes with us, DJ?
Sure, I'd be glad to. First of all, I was really happy to see that Barbara at Winrose has tomatillos. And for the summertime, I'm crazy about corn. I grew up in the Midwest, so I've been making a corn pudding and then putting scallops and a tomatillo sauce and then a little tomato avocado salsa, some creme fraiche on it. So
that is amazing. That sounds so good. Now, to explain and kind of describe what a tomatillo looks like and how it tastes.
Well, they have a husk on the exterior of them. So you've got this kind of papery husk, and then underneath you have this greenish-yellow fruit, which needs attention. You need other things to it. So I roast them in the oven with white onions, Anaheim chilies, garlic, until they blacken. And then I put all that into my blender with a big chunk of cilantro and grind it out, pulse it until it takes maybe 10 to 15 seconds to pulse it. And then you add a little bit of salt, a little bit of sugar to it. Sometimes you don't need to add sugar if the tomatillos are ripe. But these are not. They're nice and green. And then you have this really beautiful dark green sauce that has all the flecks, the dark flecks from where the tomatillos have charred and the peppers have charred. And then we put that in a squeeze bottle, and we put this corn pudding. I love corn, and it's really coming to the market in great quantities right now. Almost everybody has it. We take milk and then whisk in corn flour to it, and then we take corn and do it on a box grater, so you get all the
milk from the corn.
Milk, and then you whisk that in. Mm-hmm. And that's the basis that we put in a bowl, and we pan sear scallops, and we drizzle it with the tomatillo sauce, and then in the center we put tomatoes and avocado and drizzle creme fraiche over the whole.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a nice thing for the summer. It's really simple to make. I mean, you just heat up milk until it's almost boiling, and then I get kind of a medium coarse ground cornmeal and whisk that in until it starts to thicken. And then you put in the fresh corn and whisk that till it thickens, and then you finish it with salt and lime juice.
That's it.
That's it, yeah. And it holds really a long time. I mean, it holds like 3 days because it's just corn and milk. It's kind of a fancy cream corn. I'm just taking off this really great Texas chef, Robert Del Grande.
Sounds great. Now, if you can't get a hold of scallops, is there something else you could kind of sear and put on top?
Well, you could use any kind of fish. I mean, you could use, you know, different kinds of... right now, the white sea bass are running. Those are really nice because you just pan sear them in a little olive oil till they get a nice color on them, and then put those pieces of fish on there. It's really good.
Oh, it just sounds so great.
Yeah.
Always inspiring, yeah.
Yeah.
That was DJ Olson. He's the chef at Lou, and Lou is this great little wine bar restaurant, and it's in a shopping center next to a laundromat. Tell us exactly where it is.
724 North Vine Street, just a half block north of Melrose on Vine, on the east side of the street. And the shopping mall is called Melrose Place.
Melrose Place. All right. As always, DJ, it's a great recipe. Can't wait to go home and try it.
Okay.
You can't help but notice some of these beautiful fresh shell beans that are on the tables. They're the kind you just want to walk up and just put your hands in and just feel them because they're so gorgeous and shiny. And we're visiting with Eric from Fairview Garden, who has at least three different kinds on the table today.
Yeah, the shelling beans is one of our favorites at Fairview. It's basically just, you know, beginning of the summertime is when they come on strong. We carry Trail of Cherokee Tears is a dark purple. I'd say it's just, you know, a medium-sized shelling bean. The flageolet, which is the very, very popular traditional favorite of everyone here in Santa Monica.
The little pale green
ones. Yeah, and then we have the tongue of fire, which is like a red-striped Italian Barotto cooking bean. Mm-hmm. And but what's great about these beans is they're all fresh. There's no need to soak them. These beans are the ones you normally get from the store dry. You have to soak them overnight and then cook them. These ones, there's no need for soaking them. And they're just absolutely tender, sweet, delicious. Each bean has a little bit of its own different quality. But on the whole, the texture and the flavor is second to none.
And how do you cook them?
I recommend cooking them all in a similar kind of manner. And then from there, you can use them however you like. So just basic cooking is bringing them to a boil from cold water and then simmering them. I like to put garlic, a little onion, a little peeled potato, tomato, fresh herbs, a bay leaf in the water, and just bring them to a boil and let it simmer away. Depending on your bean size, you're looking from 25 to 35 minutes. And then once they're cooked, let them sit in the liquid. Let them cool down in the liquid. They're gonna absorb more moisture. They're going to absorb more flavor. And then your bean is just, you're real happy. once they're cooked, then you can take them out of the liquid. You can saute them up. You can make a ragu. You can crush them up chilled with some fresh olive oil and Parmesan. And the sky's the limits, really, once they're cooked.
And how much are they?
We're doing them at $9 a pound.
And, out of the shell.
Out of the shell. Mm-hmm. In the shell, they're $5 a pound.
A pound of beans is a lot of beans. That's going to feed a lot of people.
Yeah, you want to think about 2 to 4 ounces of beans per person is a safe guess. Unless you guys really, really get along well and you don't mind the extra heat in the house, you know.
That was Eric Stenberg, and he is the apprentice over there at Fairview Gardens up in Goleta, which is near Santa Barbara. And he's down at the market, and he's sharing recipes with not only us, but with the customers right here. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Pictures, recipes, and notes of what's fresh at the market can be found on the Good Food blog. Laura Avery posts a weekly roundup of what's in season. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to read more. The life of a California farmer is fraught with turmoil. The state budget crisis, the drought, crop diseases. What farmers are doing in light of all this, that's next on Good Food on 89.9 KCRW. News of California's budget crisis isn't really news anymore, but combine that crisis with the drought hitting farmers in the Central Valley, and you have a situation that's a real challenge to manage. A.G. Kawamura is the secretary of the California Department of Food and Agriculture. He comes from a longtime farming family in Orange County. So let's talk about that budgetary problem right now. How has the state's agricultural sector, and in particular your department, been affected?
Well, the ag sector itself continues to be one of the bright spots in the state's economy. You have individual crop arenas or commodity arenas like the milk industry, the dairy industry, for example, that has been really suffering for over a year now. But you have other bright spots. Some of the fruits and vegetable arenas still are doing very well. Of course, in our nut industry, which is almonds and walnuts, pistachios, they continue to plow into new good areas. So the industry itself, our farm gate for 2007, which is the price of products being sold from the farm to the next user or the next industry that will take it and turn, for example, grapes into wine or milk into ice cream. That farm gate was a record in 07, 08. We've assumed that we'll have some pretty high numbers as well. 2009, I think we're going to see some shutdown, some decline, partly because of the decline in the export markets with the global climate shift and the global economic shift, I guess, downwards. There's just a lot less product being sold in our exports, and exports make up almost a quarter, a little bit more than that, of our total ag sales here.
Let's talk for a minute about the drought. Central and Southern California have been reeling from this drought, but it's the drought is much more complex. It's not just
the idea of rain not falling.
Right.
There's a lot of water policy issues that are really affecting farmers in a negative way. Could you sort of lay out the situation for us with water right now in the valley?
Well, maybe one way to look at the drought. The drought is a symptom of a larger problem that I think we as a state especially have to prepare ourselves for. Our state, just by the nature of it, has water shortage areas, water areas where really the rainfall we know it predictably is not going to fall. And so over the course of really 100 years, we've developed a pretty amazing system to try and deal with the predictable rainfall or snowfall where it exists, and then make sure and move it to where we can use it and then create basically the abundance that we have as a state. Our challenge or our opportunity is, before some of these things happen, can we build an infrastructure that allows us to thrive and live through these kind of new impacts, or are we going to be out like Australia and fail to plan for some predictable challenges that we see in the future? And how we do that then affects certainly our agricultural systems, but also it affects every citizen in the state as well.
Now, some of this water situation has also been caused by choices to protect some species of fish. Isn't that so?
Absolutely. And the Endangered Species Act is a very, very powerful and very important part of this nation's commitment to species that are finding themselves on the verge of extinction or moving in that direction. And in our state, then, we have both salmon and smelt, two fishes that we are currently in the process of protecting that have held up some deliveries of water because of the danger to those species.
So, in other words, water that could flow down into irrigation use is being kept in river systems so that the fish have somewhere to swim.
For different reasons, yes. And you might call that part of it a regulatory drought at the same time that we have an actual geological drought as well.
One of the things that I'd like to ask you about is the idea of all of these food contamination outbreaks, which seem to affect California a lot. I mean, the spinach, pistachios are all California. What's being done to protect California farmers against these outbreaks that occur?
Well, it's interesting. The dual thing of protecting the farmers as well as protecting the consumer, those are actually two very important and linked efforts. Certainly when we have, as happened last year, there was a food scare. First it became an accusation that it might be tomatoes, and eventually it became clear that it was peppers, different kinds of jalapeno peppers from not even in this country, and yet the tomato market collapsed because of that challenge, and many, many growers just really were found themselves with a wonderful product that they couldn't sell because of consumer fear. When you have a foodborne illness, one of the challenges right now is how quickly can we identify where the product is, how much of it is contaminated, if it is, isolate it from the rest of the food supply and move on. It doesn't help if you're talking to someone who has become gravely ill or has lost a child or a parent or a child to some foodborne illness, pathogen like Salmonella or E. coli or some of these other Listeria. These are very serious diseases, but it's one of those. It's another thing to think that we'll ever get to zero and that we can protect everybody 100% of the time. Every time there is a foodborne illness in this country, I would submit that the system tightens down a little bit more and becomes a little bit better because two things: nobody wants to see anybody hurt, and secondarily, no industry wants to have consistent accidents coming in their commodity group because it'll ruin their commodity. And so what you see is our system moving towards better places, better practices, better mechanisms to detect and exclude, we say, keep out the pathogens out of the food supply. And yet at the same time, we also have to recognize there's a lot of work to be done on toughening up our own human gut, you know, that so that instead of getting gravely ill, you might get a mild case of the runs. These are all very difficult things to talk about, but at the same time, they're very easy things to talk about because the goal, I think, is a healthy, safe, reliable, abundant food supply.
A.G. Kawamura is the Secretary of the California Department of Food and Agriculture. Chances are the first time you heard about the Chinese ethnic minority known as the Uyghurs was when violence broke out a few weeks ago in China. The Uyghurs are a Turkic ethnic group, and I knew there was probably some interesting food in that culture. I'll be back on Good Food to get a taste of Uyghur cuisine. That's next on KCRW and KCRW.com. When I started to hear about the Uyghurs at the northwestern edge of China, I knew it was time to check in once more with Naomi Duguid. Naomi and her husband, Jeffrey Alford, are two of my absolute favorite authors. They explore the food culture of the Uyghurs in Beyond the Great Wall, Recipes and Travels in the Other China. Hi, Naomi.
Hi there, Evan.
So we've been hearing about the Uyghurs for the last week or so in the news. Who are they?
Well, it's a large population that lives in the oases in western China. It's the big sort of desert area in western China. And they have been, for the longest time, the oasis people, so traders and agriculturalists. In the oases, they grow, it gets very hot in the summer, cold in the winter, and they grow, you know, tomatoes and cucumbers, and they're famous for their melons. And when the Chinese then took over that part of what is now China, you know, it was Uyghur territory. So there's always that, you know, they're sort of part of the Chinese empire now. Oh, Evan, for food, you really have to go there sometime in, say, I don't know, July through October, because there's these piles of melons and tomatoes so ripe because they're grown in hot sun. And, you know, in the oases, there's shade trees and the sound of water flowing in ditches. And it's a fascinating part of the world.
What are some of the dishes that particularly struck you from the Uyghurs?
Well, the really classic one, and in fact, this goes back to our first book, Flatbreads and Flavors. The first recipe in our first book was for a Uyghur flatbread. So flatbreads is one big sort of thing. And then kebabs, you know, it's they're Turkic people. They speak a Turkic language. And so you have skewers of a lamb, chunks of lamb, or it could be lamb liver. I mean, there's specialized skewers, but generally a kebab sprinkled with a little cumin, a little cayenne pepper, and a little salt, cooked over a grill, and that's sort of street food. I mean, you could think souvlaki in Greece. You know, it's that kind of lovely smell of grilled meat as you walk down the street.
And do they have any relishes or pickles that they make to accompany these grilled meats?
Well, there's usually sort of a fresh salad, you know, a chopped salad. You can have sort of finely chopped, they kind of resemble some of those Arab salads, onions and tomatoes chopped small, or cooling cucumbers chopped small, that kind of thing. And then you eat it with a bread. And the other thing they have, of course, is for special occasions, you'll have that kind of pilaf kind of dish, which is, you know, cooked by men in the same way as paella is in Spain. And it'll have lamb in it, and it might have quince, for example. Gorgeous, just delicious.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
And then as a general condiment, there's often sort of a black rice vinegar and mixed with soy. And then they have this wonderful blend of sort of, it's Central Asian version of something you might find in the Mediterranean. You know, it's cooked peppers and onions and tomato with a little lamb in it, and it's served as a sauce over fresh noodles. I mean, again, there's a sort of what could be bad quality.
Wow. It's interesting, too, because they're at a place geographically where so many different countries and cultures come together.
That's right. Yeah, they're separated. You know, there's these mountain ranges, but if you go north from Xinjiang, where are you? You connect to sort of Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, and these are all Turkic peoples. They're all closely related. In fact, Uyghur language and Uzbek language are very close. And so that Soviet Central Asia, I mean, Chinese Central Asia, you know, many Uyghur nationalists call it East Turkestan, because really that was the old term for that sort of big place in the middle of the map, you know, which has all these related peoples in it. And there's Afghan, you know, they're border piece of Afghanistan, and it's a very interesting part of the world. And so it's been caravanserai. You know, Marco Polo went through there. All these Silk Road caravans went through there. So there's been enormous trade and movement of ideas along through those oases along the Silk Road. And that's where the Uyghurs are from.
Wow. Thank you so much, Naomi.
Lovely talking to you, Evan.
Naomi Duguid and her husband, Jeffrey Alford, write and photograph incredible books on world food cultures, including Beyond the Great Wall, Recipes and Travels in the Other China. They have a truly enviable life. To learn more about them and their books, go to kcrw.com/goodfood. Ugh, it's been hot outside, so that means it's time to eat some flavorful and delicious cold soups. Ideas to beat back the heat coming up next. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW, and I'm your host, Evan Kleiman. When it starts getting hot outside, soup just may be the answer. Right now, I'm talking about cold soup. Noted cooking teacher and author Cliff Wright is here to take us through some ways to cool off with soup. Now, do you think that people are afraid of cold soups?
I'm not sure if they're afraid of cold soups. I just don't think they can think beyond gazpacho.
And vichyssoise.
And vichyssoise, which I don't think anybody actually makes, although I like it.
I like it hot better than cold.
Yeah.
What is it? We should say what vichyssoise is.
Well, vichyssoise is a fancy name for what used to be called potato and milk soup. And that's really what it is. It's a potato and milk soup.
With a little
of leeks and onions, right. It's sort of old-fashioned. You don't see it much anymore.
Now, even gazpacho, many of us think of the tomato-based soup. And some people think of chunky gazpacho. Some people think of the, quote, more authentic pureed gazpacho. But even if you look at Spanish cold soups in general, they go so much beyond gazpacho.
There's gazpacho, first of all, is native to Andalusia, which is the most southern region of Spain, and also the region most heavily influenced by the Arabs, who were there for about 700 years. So a lot of these soups had these sort of vague Arab feeling to them. One of the most famous is Ayo Blanco, which is a white gazpacho made with finely blended almonds and garlic and water and grapes. And it's served chilled.
It's fabulous.
And it's fabulous. But the key is making sure everything is very finely ground, because if it's not, then those little bits of almond kind of stick in your throat, and that's not pleasant. And you can just imagine how difficult this must have been to make, how time-consuming with
a mortar and pestle.
A mortar and pestle pounding away for hours.
Wow. So let's get beyond gazpacho and vichyssoise. What are some other chilled summer soups that you really love?
Well, one that I like a lot, and it's the kind of, it's funny because I forget to make it, is tarratour.
Tarratour. Oh, tarratour. Now, I think of that as a sauce.
Well, because it is a sauce. But if you add a little bit more yogurt and a little bit of water, you have a soup.
So what is it for people who have never heard this word?
It's basically a yogurt cucumber walnut soup. And it's blended fine and chilled. It's very simple. You just simply mix those ingredients together. Finely grated cucumbers, good quality whole plain yogurt, and crushed walnuts. And there you go. And then you finish it with a little bit of dill. Now, if you were to make it thicker, it then becomes kind of a spread or a dip or a sauce, which in Greek is known as tzatziki, in Turkish as cacık, and in Arabic as tarratour.
Oh, I love these. Give me another one.
Well, there's apple soups, of course.
Now, what do you mean apple soups, of course? I've never made an apple soup.
Well, there are a number of apple soups, and the most famous apple soups come from the great apple-growing regions of the world, and the two I have in mind are Normandy, which also is an apple soup had with some Camembert cheese. It's a chilled soup and a little bit of leek and potato with the apples, all blended together.
So is it sort of like you're making an applesauce? Are you peeling the apples?
No, it's quite fine. Yes, you're peeling the apples, but it's a little bit finer than that, smoother than that. Now, the Polish version is closer to an applesauce, and that's made with raisins and lemon.
That almost sounds like it would be a dessert.
I don't think of them as dessert soups. I think of them and call them chilled soups. So they're not necessarily eaten at the end of the meal. Very often, they're eaten at the beginning of the meal. As you would a soup course. And I guess it's just that sweet soups don't appeal to me, but I don't mind some sweetness, if you know, kind of get the distinction there.
Sure, absolutely. Because there are some Scandinavian fruit soups.
Oh, yes, especially the Finns. They love that kind of stuff, prune soups and things like that. But again, the Scandinavians tend to eat these as almost like desserts. But still, they're not overly sweet.
What are some other vehicles for chilled soups?
One that I always forget is a wonderful Sicilian variation of watermelon soup. Chilled soups aren't very popular in Sicily, so this is actually based on dessert, but made without some gelatin. So it's originally a pudding. The watermelon, sugar, pistachios, bits of chocolate served chilled as a soup.
This is so Arab.
It's very Arab.
So have we covered the chilled soup world?
I think we should mention a soup that, as best I can make out, only exists in California, and that's a chilled peach soup. And I often don't eat peaches in any other form than over a sink dripping juices down my chin because peaches are just so good. But there are people who like chilled peach soup, and I've never heard of this anywhere else but California. And it's basically the very ripe peaches cooked with white wine, a little creme fraiche for garnish and fresh mint, and a cinnamon stick and some cloves. And it's served chilled. And it's almost like a gazpacho. It's a very interesting dish, but the first time you eat it, you almost are quizzical. And I found when I tested this recipe, I was sort of troubled by it. So I decided I was not going to include it. I said, well, just leave it in the refrigerator. Have it tomorrow. And I did. And I finally got the idea. So I had to write about it saying, don't expect a dessert here. This is almost like a gazpacho.
Cliff Wright has written many cookbooks, including his most recent Bake Until Bubbly, the Ultimate Casserole Book. I've got recipes at kcrw.com/goodfood. We got the idea for cold soup from a listener who wrote about a cold Hungarian sour cherry soup. The recipe from our listener and the story of the Hungarian soup is on the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. There are so many choices when it comes to drinking wine, and the flavors of wine can really change depending on what you eat with it. So if you're stuck drinking Merlot or Chardonnay, instead of exploring what goes well with that Indian food dinner you're about to eat, stick around. Answers are coming. That's next up. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. One of those products that can take information geeks to nirvana and just stop regular folks cold. There's so much to know about the beverage that sometimes it's hard to learn just how do we drink for pleasure. Matt Skinner is the author of heard it through the grapevine, and he wants to teach us how to enjoy that pleasure in a simple way. One thing I've noticed in my restaurant over the last few years is whereas it used to be that people sort of slavishly wanted to be told what the correct wine pairing was to what food, now it seems that people have gotten attached to a particular wine that they feel comfortable ordering, they feel comfortable buying, that they know really well, and they want to drink that wine with everything. But what are we giving up by feeling comfortable in one place and not sort of taking the next step to learn what best can open up the eating experience?
We're giving up an enormous amount. I think knowing what you like is one thing, but knowing why you like it will open up a whole new world for you. And it's really, you really don't have to learn a huge amount to kind of get to that place. And in terms of the eating experience, you know, I think well-chosen wine can make average food taste better and vice versa. And, you know, I think we risk really missing out on some fantastic combinations.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, pairing wine with food. Is it ever not the color, like red with red meat, white with white meat? Is it ever sort of the texture or the relative heaviness of a wine?
Absolutely. I always start with weight, and I try and match the weight of my wine to the weight of the dish. And I think about things. So if you've got a sort of a delicate salad with sort of lighter ingredients, I'm always thinking about a wine that's got a sort of a similar weighted body to that. And then from there, you know, obviously there'll be obvious ideas about whether it'll be white and red. And then I look for hooks in terms of flavor or contrasts, but sort of contrasts that work. And then I also look and I think about tools. And what I mean by tools is that wine has things like acid and it has tannin. And those can be really useful as for kind of pairings and helping to cut through fat in food and also clean your palate after you've had a mouthful of food. So kind of bear all of that in mind when I'm putting together a combination.
Well, here in America, we're very similar to Australia in that we like a diverse palate of foods during the course of a week. And we really embrace Asian and Indian foods, which some people think can be more challenging to pair with food and are often thought of as being beer foods. Tell me a little bit about how one can approach eating Asian and Indian food with a great bottle of wine.
Yeah, I think it really depends on the style of food you're having. And when we talk Asian, it can really range massively from kind of those fragrant, lighter and really aromatic styles of Asian food, Thai and Vietnamese, where you know, you've got cornerstones of sweet, sour, salty and spicy all sort of competing. And wine finds kind of each of those individually in any amount kind of quite challenging. And when you put two or three of those components together, it makes it a incredibly tough ask. And then when you talk about Indian food as well, it really depends on whether it's from the north of India where the food tends to be a bit heavier and sort of this cream-based sauces or whether or not you go further south to like the coast to Kerala where you've got lots of seafood and dried fruit. And I often find that with Indian food in particular, if you can get food from the south, it tends to work better with wine just purely because there's less cream and there's less kind of ghee used in the cooking. I always find that I have good success with grape varieties like Gewürztraminer and Riesling with that kind of food, but and Viognier as well, the other white grape native to the Northern Rhone.
Let's talk for a moment about colors in wine, the hues and the different ways the wine looks and the amount of clarity. All of that comes into play. So what should we look for in terms of whiteness when we're looking at a white wine?
It really depends on the variety because each variety, comes with its own color and whites can, as you say, range from just about neutral and water-like right through to kind of a coppery sort of orangey color. And there's a couple of things that can affect that. It can be production. If the wine's had some contact with oak, that can influence color. If the wines had exposure to oxygen, that can influence colour and tend to darken white wines as well. And also if a wine's older, generally as wine gets older, white wine tends to get a bit darker with age. Red wine tends to get a bit lighter with age. But then you've got grape varieties. If we move into reds, things like Pinot Noir, and Pinot Noir's got quite a thin skin. And the colour, obviously, for red wine comes from the grape skins being in contact with the juice, which is clear to begin with. And, you know, the longer that those skins are in contact with the juice, theoretically, the more colour you get. But Pinot being quite thin-skinned, you end up with kind of a lighter colour than, say, Cabernet, for example. Cabernet Sauvignon, which has quite a thick skin and will always end up with kind of quite deep colours.
Matt, it's been such a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Heard It Through the Grapevine, The Things You Should Know to Enjoy Wine, is Matt Skinner's book. He oversees wine operations for the 15 Group worldwide. If you're really into a vintage or wine right now, please share it with me. I confess that wine is not my strong point, so advice from you is always welcome. Share it with all of us at Good Food by posting a comment on the show page. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood and select Latest Show. Did you know that every culture has a version of the meatball? Well, it's true. Same goes with milkshakes. Well, almost all cuisines have a version of the milkshake. I'll tell you about some from Turkey to Mexico to Colombia. That's coming up next on Good Food, right here on KCRW and KCRW.com. Milkshakes. Hey, if you can say no to one, more power to you. I cannot. Travel the world and you can find chili combos that go quite a bit beyond the vanilla or chocolate milkshake that we think about. Adam Reed traveled through immigrant communities of the U.S. to discover some real treats. His wicked, wicked book is Thoroughly Modern Milkshakes. Well, I don't know whether to say thank you for writing this book or please go away and take it with you.
We'll advocate the balanced diet, a shake one day, a salad the next.
Yeah, I think we have to. But, you know, some of these that come from foreign places are actually not as intense as the American ones. Let's start with the cholado. Where does it hail from originally?
The chelado is Colombian originally, and I would have loved to go straight there to do my research, you know, absolutely on the mark there. But I ended up going to the Jackson Heights neighborhood in Queens, which is a heavily Latino neighborhood. But a chelado, it's a wonderful combination of shaved ice and condensed milk for sweetness and some kind of fruit concentrate, usually strawberry or passion fruit, something along those lines. And then on top of all of that, you get very finely chopped up fruit. And on top of that, you get coconut and then a little more condensed milk and then a cherry on top. And it, to me, it's sort of like the slushy meets the fruit salad.
You mentioned that you were also tasting batidos as you were walking around in Jackson Heights. Now, what are they and how are they different from chelados?
A batido is really more a beverage. A chelado turns liquidy as it melts, but a batido starts out essentially as a fruit shake, but with no ice cream. They're from Central America and the Caribbean. I actually tasted them in Costa Rica a couple of years ago. And it is ice blended with fresh fruit and sometimes milk and often a little bit of sweetener. It can be sugar or it can be honey and a squirt of lime juice. And I think sweetened condensed milk is also popular with a batido. Another version of the batido is the Mexican version, and that's called a licuado, which is essentially the same thing, although sometimes it doesn't have milk. You know, that's just it's fruit, and ice and a little sweetener and a little lime. And that's also very refreshing. These have definitely a lighter texture than a classic American shake that's loaded with ice cream. I'm also a huge fan of the agua fresca.
Oh, we love aguas frescas out here.
Yeah, yeah. Aguas frescas are wonderful. And strawberry and jamaica and lime and pineapple, all kinds of fruits work beautifully for it. And it's just fruit and water and a little sweetener and a little lime.
Now let's go to a different part of the world and take a look at some of the yogurt-based drinks. Maybe you could start with the lassi.
Of the yogurt-based drinks, which are prevalent throughout the Middle East and in Turkey and in India, I think lassi, which is an Indian version, may be the most well-known in this country. I know that, you know, when I went to Indian restaurants as a kid, I was always allowed to order a mango lassi, which is a sweetened yogurt and mango puree, you know, probably a little thicker than heavy cream. And I always loved them. And, I wanted to put some of these yogurt drinks in the book and started researching them and actually found out something I didn't know, which is that there are savory versions. There are salted lassis.
Mm-mm, yum.
You know, that's a taste that I'm still developing. I drink them every now and then. but I have a sweet tooth, so I go for the sweet lassis. But I do have a recipe for a salted lassi, which I put a little bit of fresh jalapeno in for sort of the spark. And there's also a sweet lassi. They're often flavored with rose water or a little raspberry or, as I said, mango. I put some cardamom in the sweet lassi because I'm a cardamom freak.
Mm. But that mango lassi, that is just, there's something so luscious about that drink.
Aren't mangoes the greatest? I just love them.
Now, the other yogurt drink I want to talk about is the one that's that has a little bit of carbonated water. I know in Iran it's called doogh. I think you have a Turkish version.
Which is called Ayran. It's A-Y-R-A-N. And it is. It's yogurt and sparkling water just beaten together. That one doesn't go in the blender at all. And I put in a tiny little pinch of salt. And it is remarkably refreshing. I have taken to drinking those. It comes out, you know, about the texture somewhere maybe of half and half or heavy cream. And it just, you know, it's light and it's tangy and it wakes up your whole palate. It's great in the morning, actually.
Adam, thank you so much. You have certainly given me a lot of thought about what I'm going to drink during the summer.
I'm glad. I hope everybody enjoys it. Thank you very much for having me.
Adam Reed became a milkshake expert while writing his book, Thoroughly Modern Milkshake. Find the recipes at kcrw.com/goodfood. And as always, I love your suggestions. I talked a little longer to Adam Reed about a corn milkshake. Hear it on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. One thing I love to do with ice cream is to make a root beer float. I've got a new brand of root beer that I'm selling at Angeli called Margot's Bark. Tim Ude and his 7-year-old son Oscar first made it for the school science fair. It was so good, they decided to bottle it. They named it after their rescued Labrador retriever, Margot, and proceeds from sales go to dog shelters. I went to the Ude's house to talk to Tim and to meet Margot. How did the idea for the science project unfold?
This goes back now a little over a year to last, probably like February of 08. He came home with a flyer, and it said, hey, the science fair is coming up. You know, work with your child to come up with some type of experiment if they want to participate. I guess I was just thinking about stuff I did when I was a kid, and then I kind of recalled that, hey, you know, I used to make root beer, and there's good science in that, right? I mean, the yeast, you know, interacts with the sugar, and you get what we were calling yeast farts. the carbonation. And I think it in part turned into what it is today because he was so interested in it. We made multiple batches and experimented with the flavoring even though it was just, you know, with extract. At that point, we would put in more sugar, you know, like molasses, no molasses. We went through a couple batches and over the course of really 2 months, I think, leading up to the science fair.
So the process of taking the homemade root beer and then going out and finding a brewer, a commercial brewer, so that you could make a product that you could bottle and sell, was it difficult? Was it hard to find a flavor that you wanted? Did you work with them closely?
Well, yeah, it was actually really interesting. I think that was one of the great things about doing it with Oscar is that neither my wife nor I had any experience in the grocery business or the beverage business. So we kind of figured it out as we went. And we worked with the real most time-consuming thing was when we worked with a flavorist. We worked with him for about 9 months, and we went back and forth on the flavor, you know, repeatedly. I mean, we went through 10 or 12 iterations on the flavor to get it to where we wanted it. And along the way, we sampled a lot of different root beers. And so for months, as you can imagine with a seven-year-old, we just would tasting different kind of root beers, and it was a lot of fun, and you learn. I mean, it was like the chemistry of building the formula in a way. And then once we had the flavor that we liked, we brought it to the brewer. There's a contract brewer that we're working with who brews beer and soda for Whole Foods, amongst other markets. So he's a really high-end brewer, really great brewer. We wanted an all-natural beverage, so we needed a brewer so it could be pasteurized, and they kind of went from there.
What is the family's connection to Shelter Dogs that made you decide that the proceeds from selling Margo's Bark root beer would go to support shelters?
Well, we rescued Margo, who's now 3.5, when she was 8 or 9 weeks old, and she's been a wonderful addition to the family, and life wouldn't be the same without her.
Find a list of where to buy Margo's Bark at our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. I'm doing a feature for the summer called Pie a Day. I have pledged to make a pie every day this summer. That's about 90 of them. I'm up to about pie number 25. Check out the pies I've made so far, plus a new feature we have called Eat a Pie a Day, where you, the audience, show me the pies you're eating this summer. I make the pie, you eat the pie. Sounds like a good deal to me. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood to check it out. Oh, and get ready to drool. Even though we're in an economic freefall, this country is a place where you can rely on getting water easily. Unless you live in Hale County, Alabama. 3 out of 4 households in this county is not connected to the municipal water supply. That means residents are often drinking untreated water, sometimes contaminated with sewage. What one group is doing to help this community. That's next on Good Food on 89.9 KCRW. Would you believe that there are communities here in the U.S. that are unable to get clean drinking water piped into their homes? Well, that's the reality for some families in Hale County, Alabama. 2 years ago, we spoke to Pam Doerr, the Director of Housing for HERO, the Hale Empowerment and Revitalization Organization. She's an advocate for residents' access to clean water. One of their initiatives is the Buy a Meter Project, which helps families obtain water meters for their homes. We called her to get an update on HERO's progress.
For some families, it's just the cost of a water meter that keeps them from getting safe drinking water. The cost of a meter is about $425 for the average family. And for some families, it's almost a month's income.
Wow. And 2 years ago, when we first heard about you, it was through an article in Good Magazine. I'm curious to know what's happened during the last 2 years. Are things better?
Things have really changed. 119 families have gotten running water. We've got a total of $50,000 in donations, and we were helping them to get water meters. We've also started a really close relationship with the water systems, like the County Water Board, so that we work together closely. Number one, just to make sure that they're able to supply lines to the family's home if we can help with the meter cost. And then also working with the families closely to make sure through budgeting they can afford the cost of the monthly charge for water once the meter's in. Because there's no reason to pay for a meter if the family can't afford to pay for the water. And it's all really worked out well for us. We're really excited. It's just been incredible to see the change for an elderly person getting water for the first time at their home. It's been really incredible.
It's amazing to me that in the 21st century, we have to experience happiness for somebody getting water for the first time. It's quite shocking.
I know what you mean. I think the first time, I had probably lived here for a full year before I realized the extent of the water issues in rural parts of Alabama. And, you know, there's counties all over Alabama, all over the South, with many families that still don't have drinking water. I think in our county alone, it's still over 1,000 families that don't have access to safe drinking water.
Now that you've started working with the county and working directly with the water board, do other parts of the population, are they donating, are they expressing support, or is most of the help coming from outside the state?
Generally, it's been from outside the state, and I think most local families aren't using the Internet anyway, so they're not as familiar with what's happening. But a few of the ones that have become aware from volunteers coming in to help, they just express surprise. They're like, wow, in our community, really? And so that part of it's been really kind of empowering to kind of educate our own community about what's happening here. It's so easy sometimes not to see what goes on.
Has there been a sense of shame that it took outside people to come in and change?
I think there was some anger initially when the project first went on live on the web from a few local families that felt like maybe we weren't treating the county with as much respect and letting people know that there was a need here kind of angered some people that maybe it was better not to say that there was a need versus get those families help. And since that time, it's really shifted. I think the families getting the water are just so grateful. There's no reason to think about anything else, you know.
Pam Dorr is the Director of Housing for the Hale Empowerment and Revitalization Organization. Read about the Buy a Meter program and other projects at kcrw.com/goodfood. The food community in New York is excited about Chef Michael Serino. He runs an underground supper club that tries to bridge the gap between fancy pants restaurants and everybody's home kitchen. Find out what everybody's talking about when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. Imagine getting together with a group of like-minded folks who want to increase their culinary skills. Well, over the course of 24 hours, you're going to get to know each other really well, and as a result, create a whole lot of really fascinating food. Michael Serino runs the underground supper club, A Razor, a Shiny Knife, in New York. He's made foodie headlines for making 24 courses in 24 hours. What's the difference between a supper club and a restaurant?
I think the difference really boils down to a matter of consistency. I think as consumers, we take for granted how difficult it is to run a restaurant and how difficult it is to be a chef in a restaurant, besides the exhausting hours and like the grueling work itself. But the level of perfection that you seek to attain is second to none, because the best part about great restaurants is consistency. You need to go into a restaurant on a Monday morning and have, you know, a brilliant bowl of pasta, and then show up 6 months later and be able to re-experience that same emotion, that same visceral sensation. And without consistency and without attention to detail, that stuff would be impossible. But with the supper club, the limits are ungrounded. You know, you can really do whatever you like, whatever fancies yourself for the day, and you can do it with your friends in a very calm and social environment. And of course, trying to cook 24 courses of food from scratch in 24 hours becomes a bit exhausting eventually. For the most part, it's really just a social event that happens to culminate with a nice meal, something that would be very similar to just eating at your family's house on a holiday.
And that's a lot what A Razor, Shiny Knife is about, because people, in fact, can choose to come in and experience the sort of experience early and watch.
I mean, I would say that if you would like to participate in an event that we throw and you do not come early, then you've missed a majority of what our experience is, because our goal here is to create an atmosphere that's is really nice for social interaction, that allows for a bit of education and then eventually has some sort of theatrical component to it. But that introductory part, the social and educational bit, go hand in hand so well together. You know, if you were to just show up and expect dinner, you know, there's nothing separating us from a restaurant at that point, except for the fact that we're only making that food for one night.
Are people learning to do things that range from sort of traditional, let's say, making pasta to molecular gastronomy?
The start to this, the spark that let this all go was my desire to learn more about the cooking that I had grown up with. And my partner Danielle's desire to teach me. My partner Danielle Castagno is a brilliant trained chef, and he makes amazing Italian food. So as we became friends, you know, many years ago, I would ask him questions. You know, I know how to make pasta, but it's always a little bit dry. Or, you know, how does this process work? And, you know, can you explain to me why duck confit gets crispy, or how I can make it crispier? And as these simple traditional questions started to get answered, I started to progress farther and farther into the whole process of learning. But then we started asking questions that we both needed the answers for. And that pushed us beyond just Italian and French cuisine to all sorts of cuisines around the world. And over the last year, our hopes and our striving for perfection has led us to modern cooking. And with modern cooking, we've been able to then now execute ideas that we've had and things that we were able to really strive for that would have been impossible in a regular home kitchen. We've been able to make completely feasible and actually execute beautifully because of the allowances that modern cooking gives us.
And you recently actually did this dinner that was written up all over the place. 24 courses in 24 hours. And then, of course, you did a dinner which recreated a very famous dinner that Thomas Keller and Grant Achatz did, a 20-course tasting menu, which most people would have said could not be done outside of a very sophisticated restaurant kitchen.
I appreciate you saying that. It was the most technically difficult food in the world. I mean, Mr. Keller and Mr. Achatz are just brilliant geniuses who strive for perfection in their restaurants every single day. And to try to learn from what they were doing was an honor. And, you know, the environment that we try to create, although some attention to detail is necessary, at the same time, it's really kind of an open exploration, because some of the things that we were doing there, you know, we had understood, you know, I had conceptually prepared for, but, you know, when ingredients cost hundreds of dollars an ounce, it's really hard to practice them without it being the actual, you know, the day of the event. So, you know, we were always crossing our fingers and diving headfirst into stuff and hoping that we could just rely on our experience to be able to pull us through. And the guests were along for every bit of that ride. You know, they found, pleasure, hopefully, in every single success and every single failure that we made. And then as we moved on to the next day, we were able to learn and grow from it.
Thank you so much, Michael.
I appreciate it, Evan. Thank you very much for having me.
A Razor, a Shiny Knife is the Underground Supper Club run by Michael Serino. You can learn about his 24-course dinner served in 24 hours at kcrw.com/goodfood. Connect with me and other Good Food listeners by becoming a fan of me on Facebook. We do cookbook giveaways and share food pics and stories. Follow me on Twitter, too. I'm at Evan Kleiman, only one N in the last name. You can download the show and podcast it, too. Find the Good Food video app and find all the info we talked about at kcrw.com/goodfood. The executive producer of Good Food is Jennifer Farrow. Harriet Ells produced and edited this program along with Holly Tarson, Bob Carlson, Connie Alvarez, and Candace Moyer. I'm Evan Kleiman. Tune in next week for another edition of Good Food.